Well, who's got a story? I'll talk about Claus in a minute, maybe. I just don't want to monopolize the brethren here. Do you have a story? Just want to listen? That's fine. Where are you from? Where is that?
Do you know where Minneapolis is? It's like 120 miles
northwest. Northwest, oh yeah, okay. A lot of Minnesotans up here. Where are you now?
Seattle.
God's country again, huh?
He's even closer than Virginia.
No. He smiled.
We're close enough.
Yeah, our name is from Arcata, California. But it's pretty tough to find it back in St. Louis, so Eugene's definitely.
I want you to know, though, that one of the staff said to me, you must have, you're from California, she said, you must have been raised in California. I said, yeah. I was. I said, how did you know? She said, I could tell. And I said, she said, I knew you weren't from Minnesota or the Midwest. And I said, why? She said, because you have a certain accent.
Well,
and so,
is,
see, you told me that we didn't have an accent.
This is funny because just yesterday I turned to her and I said, you know, this may sound terrible, but the other day I heard you talk on the patio and I turned to my husband and I said, she's got to be from Minnesota. And she said, well, why?
She said, I have a certain California accent, so there must be something. No.
You talk good.
Yeah, Californians don't have accents. Well, stories? You got one? You just want to listen and tell one?
I'll listen and I'll take it.
Okay, how about you? You want me to tell a story?
Yeah, the story, buddy.
All right, just to get it going. I'll talk about Claus then. This is one I talked about the other day. That's why I was sort of hesitant to do it, because I didn't want to bore everybody to death, but some of you haven't heard it. It started because I went, a little chipmunk just went across. His jowls full, as usual. I guess pickings must be better inside than out. Well, we started when I was a kid, traveling. I got to kind of lead up to this a little bit. And traveling was always a sort of an adventure for us because we always went back to southern Illinois on the farm, Christmas and summertime. And I was always the kid who rode in the back of the car with the dogs. And my father, as I said the other day, I kept calling him frugal, but he's really tight. Since there's only a small group here, I can be honest. Very tight. I won't say how tight, but very tight. So tight that when we came to lunch, he would always send my mother in, whom we called woman, and said, buy bologna and bread, and she would come out with bologna and bread, and he would slap out his hand, she would put a big piece of bread down, and slap a piece of bologna down, slap another piece of bread down, roll it up and hand it to him, and that would be lunch. And breakfast and supper was always the same. We never stopped anywhere. And she would always give me, the kid in the back, put a bologna sandwich over the thing, and the dogs would grab it because I can't stand bologna. So we'd travel for hours and hours and hours with no movement out of my father, no words, no how are you, do you enjoy the scenery, do you have to go to the bathroom, would you like to stop to eat, nothing. Just absolute silence because he's got to get down the line, was his favorite term. So when I had to go to the bathroom, he'd always say, can't stop. And that would last for maybe 50 miles. And I'd say, well, I got to go to the bathroom again. He said, can't stop, got to get down the line. So I'd always used to look out and wonder where that magical line is. Why do we have to get down it so importantly? Finally, I was doing just crazy back then. I said, I've got to go to the bathroom. He'd say, can't stop. And I'd look at my mother, and she says, the boy's got to go to the bathroom. He said, all right, look for a bathroom. So I would be out there in New Mexico looking for a bathroom. And I'd see this Whiting's Last Chance Gas, always on the other side. He'd say, can't stop, it's on the other side of the road. He kept driving. He would not stop. So naturally, on the way back from St. Louis, it was always on the wrong side of the road again. So I never went to the bathroom. He said, you got to go, you go in Los Angeles or St. Louis. You don't go in between. Well, I don't know whether he was kidding or not, but that's the way it went for every summer and Christmas, as long as I can remember. And when it came time to stop at night, we'd always pull into some little fly speck, New Mexico, at 9 o'clock at night, and he'd say to my mother, woman, go see if they've got a place for $5. So a motel room. Well, there was never anything for $5, obviously. I don't think there ever was anything for $5. But my mother would come out and shake her head no, and my father said, that's what I thought. And he would stagger out of the car and just kind of fall over something and sleep. My mother would sleep in the seat, and they would put a little blanket out on the floor, on the ground behind a gas station. That's where I would sleep. So this is the way I traveled, back and forth and back and forth. Always thought everybody was probably sleeping like gypsies under the stars. I didn't know people really went to Holiday Inns and Motel 6s and had baths and showers and things like that, because never did that. When we got back there at Christmas, I was always sort of half frightened, because when I grew up there on the farm, my relatives always scared the kids. So when I went back in the summertime, it was always sort of a reliving of this fear. And they did it not out of malevolence so much as just horsing around, I think, or just their country way. For example, they would always say, we always had chores to do, there he goes, chores to do, Bill and Jim and I. And we, after the chores, we'd get to sit out in the swing with my grandmother. It was a big thrill, my cousin and I, and she would swing us. And Bill and I would catch fireflies and put them in bottles or shove them up each other's nose or do something with fireflies. And she would tell the most ghastly ghost stories. It was always 90 degrees, and it was always humid, and we were sitting between these two maple trees and swinging, and Bill and I scared to death on either side of Granny, and Grandma would tell us these stories. And then one night I was sitting there, sort of half dozing, listening to the story, and out of the corner of my eye I saw a white figure in the bushes. I couldn't be sure if that was really seeing something or if it was really there, and I looked again, and I looked at Bill and went like this, and Granny was just swinging and telling the story. I said, look over there. And we looked at it, and it was this huge white sheeted figure rustling in the bushes, and it would move behind a tree, and it would come out around another bush. And by this time, Bill and I were not swinging, we were just standing there. We knew, and Granny was swinging and telling the story, not looking. Pretty soon this figure would rush out and grab Bill, usually, and run off down the lane with Bill over his shoulder. And I was screaming and wetting my pants, and Bill was screaming and not only wetting his pants. And the figure would stop down the lane and whip off the sheet, and it was Bill's father, my Uncle Lute. And then my father would jump out of the bushes. His name is Leslie, but for some reason they call him George. And he'd say, well, we got him that time, George. And they'd jab each other in the ribs and slap each other in the back, and away they'd go. Bill and I would be a puddle of nervous and wet, right? And Granny's back there swinging and telling stories. She said, now you boys come on back here and be good, or something will get you. Well, something already had us. But this went on all the time. I think I mentioned the other day about changing clothes. When we slept with our grandmother all the time in a great big bed, and Bill would sleep on one side of her and I'd be on the other, she was always going to tell us ghost stories. And we would get dressed, and there was a window let out on a yard. And through practice, we knew that we wouldn't go near that window because something's liable to be there. See, windows on the farm were something to be avoided any time after nightfall. It's like Dracula. When the moon comes out, you better be under the covers. And if we forgot and looked out the window, up would pop my father or Bill's father and go like that at night, and we'd drop and wet my pants again. So we got used to lying on our back and taking off our clothes and putting on our PJs. We didn't want to look out that window. I think my father and uncle must have camped under there, just very patiently on a stool or something, waiting for us to come to the window, and they'd jump up and scare us. And then they'd run off down the lawn, slapping each other in the back. And the next morning at breakfast, say, well, we got you kids, didn't we? And you better be good, because we could have been real ghosts. Well, they were real, as far as I was concerned. Scared the hell out of us, constantly. This went on. I can remember my grandmother, just out in the yard for no particular reason, she'd say, if you kids don't behave, I'm going to sell you to the gypsies. Well, there weren't any gypsies in Southern Illinois, but I didn't know they were in Czechoslovakia. I didn't know where they were. I said, gypsies? What are gypsies? And she'd paint these big descriptions of the wagons, and they steal children, and they paint the children up with colors and put bandanas around your head and put an earring in your ear and make you dance around a fire, and you can never go back to your parents again. And I said, oh, God, where are those gypsies, Granny? She's just over in the next pasture. Well, it never occurred to me to go look. I wouldn't have never gone near there. So we were always good for a little while, a few hours or a day at most. And then we'd go out riding at night with my folks once in a while, and Bill and I down in the bottom of the seat of the car playing games or playing cards or with our little cars or something, not listening to the adults, until my mother would probably say something like, you think she'll be out tonight? My father would say, oh, I hope not, because we got the kids with us, or something like that. And Bill and I would stop whatever we were doing and kind of rise up and look out over the window. And then my father would see us looking. He'd say, you know, the last time she was out here, she was dressed all in black and she was hitchhiking. And the couple that picked her up were never heard from again. Down we'd go again. And we'd always be looking for her. We figured she would be out there in black, this dark woman standing under a maple tree, not looking, just standing there waiting for a ride. And then if down the lane or down the road we'd see a black stump or a mailbox or anything that looked like it could be a person, we'd always say, "Oh, don't stop, don't stop." And my dad would invariably start putting on the brakes. "Should we pick her up?" "Oh, God, don't pick her up. Go, go, quickly." And he'd say, "All right, you kids get out." And we'd drop down, hit the gas, and he'd take off again. He'd say, "Well, it was close. You can come up now." We'd come up and look out the back. Well, this went on all the time. So you were sort of in a constant state of readiness. You know, you were on alert all the time. You were scrambled. You're ready to go, because something might be grabbing you or looking for you. The barn, of course, is ready-made for that. We would always be playing games in the barn, and, you know, it's always dark in there. And after hearing countless ghost stories and being scared all the time, if you're up in a little bitty kid running around this huge barn, which when I was a kid must have been this big, it seemed, and we would all of a sudden see a little maybe straw come filtering down from somewhere. And we knew that somebody was up in that barn. Otherwise, why would that straw or hay be filtering down? And we would get very quiet. Sometimes we would lie there. Or my cousin Jim, who was older than we and knew that nothing was up there, he'd say, "Oh, there's Stokes." Stokes was our hired man who was half crazy. And he said, "Stokes will cut your heart out." And Bill and I would drop right there in the straw, and Jim would say, "I'll go see." And then 2 hours would be going, and Bill and I were still there in their straw. They'd look at each other, "Should we move?" And Jim was up having pie or whatever. And he'd say, "Oh, you guys see Stokes down there?" But Stokes was real, and he was half crazy, and he used to threaten to burn the barn down. And he did burn the barn down once. He used to sleep out on the grass, fall asleep, and then when Bill and Jim and I were very brave, we'd get corn cobs and put feathers in the end of the corn cob, and you could really sail those suckers. And we'd get up a whole basket of those corn cobs with the feathers in the end of them that act as a rudder. And we'd get up on top of the house, and we'd sail those corn cobs way up, and they'd come down like missiles, boop, and drop and try to hit Stokes. The idea was whoever could get closest to Stokes without hitting him would be the winner. And invariably, of course, we'd want to hit him, and Stokes would jump up, and he'd look around, and he'd pick up that corn cob. He'd just lay down there. Pretty soon we'd more, and then he'd just kind of go like that. Pretty soon all our corn cobs are down there, and we got to go retrieve the corn cobs. He said we knew he was sound asleep. So we crept very quietly down off the house, down around the arbor, past the kitchen, and there's Stokes. And we'd look at each other very quietly. We'd get about 2 feet, and he'd reach out and grab you like that, and grab Bill and pound him. He took out his knife. I thought, "Oh my God, he's going to cut his ears off or cut his heart out." He would go like that, like he's really doing something. Bill would be laughing by this time, and I'd be crying, wetting my pants again. So this went on, all kinds of things happening like that, of one kind or a thing or another to kind of keep you uneasy. So when it came to Christmas time, we were so conditioned to be frightened. We weren't always frightened, you know. It was a nice, healthy childhood. It was just different. So we were conditioned to be, it's an understatement. We were conditioned to be frightened. So when my uncle would come out about a week before Christmas, he'd say, "You know, you guys really better do your chores right this time. When I tell you to wring that chicken's head, I want you to wring its head. When I tell you to slop the hogs, you better slop the hogs. When I tell you to do this, because Claus is coming." He always kind of emphasized that Claus. And I said, "What the heck is Claus?" And Bill says, "You'll see." Bill was a year older, and Jim was about 3 years older. So Christmas Eve came, and my grandmother, who always had this big set of keys, which I never saw, but somehow at Christmas Eve they would appear on a big ring, and she would take this big skeleton key out and go to the door and open the big room, the parlor it was called. And we never got in there any time during the year unless something. I was born there on December 17th in a snowstorm, and occasionally someone would die in the parlor, or the preacher would come, and all my father and uncles who were hard-shell Baptists, but you would never know it, would sort of act decent while the preacher was around. Once my aunt faded in there, I remember. But other than that, we were never allowed in there. So drop cloths were on everything. So when she opened that door, a cool air would come out, gushing out of there. And it was sort of a mysterious place. This is the parlor. So in Christmas Eve, they had the tables all lined up with candy and cookies and punch. And my uncles were in there playing a farm game called Euchre. Ever heard of that? It's an old Midwest game. And they were playing cards and smoking, and everybody was having a good time. And my girl cousins were playing some kind of a silly game. I remember of standing behind you get a bunch of people on chairs and people would stand behind you, and then you wink at somebody and you have to change chairs, and they were doing that and laughing, and people I never heard before. It must have been 1,000 people in the room, it seemed, when I was small. Bill and I were always under this big mahogany table with our little cars making little noises, and we could care less about euchre and cigars and all the girl cousins. But it was howling snow, and I remember, and my uncle would always come by the table on the way to say, he said, "You kids, good Claus is almost here." And after he said that 10 times, you're just ready to die. And we hear the snow howling outside and blowing, and sleigh bells. And then the room would get quiet. Sleigh bells would get closer and closer, and the room would get quiet, and my uncles would put down their cards and put out the cigars. And my Uncle Luther would say, "Claus don't like cigars," and they'd put them out. And my girl cousins would get quiet. And they always look at us, the little boys on the table, and said, "Here he comes." I figured, my God, he's going to carry me off to the gypsies. Well, just then there was a tremendous banging at the door. Bang, 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 bang on the door. And I looked, and everybody looked at us again. My uncle walked over and grabbed that knob and turned it. And there was Claus, this great big Santa Claus in a big Santa Claus suit and a long white beard and great big flashing eyes. And the snow was whipping in there, and he would stride in, big guy. And over his shoulders, he had this big bag of toys, and in his hand, a corn knife, a great big curving corn knife. And he would walk into the room like that and throw down those toys and look right at us and say, "Where are the little bastards?" Right to Bill and me. And Bill and I would grab each other, being the only little bastards in the whole room. We'd say, "Oh, God, he's got us now." He would walk right over and put that sword right at my throat and say, "You little cutthroats, you little devils." And he'd walk back and sit his toys down. And he would pick out toy after toy or present out of his bag and say, "Leslie Ledbetter. Where is Leslie Ledbetter?" And my dad would have to get up and come up. He'd reach for the thing and Claus and just about cut his hand off. He'd say, "No, you don't. You've got to explain a few things to me first, you cutthroat. Why were you down at the gas station last Saturday night talking to the Widow Douglas? I saw you down there. Weren't you down there?" And there all my relatives would take on. "Now, Leslie, were you really down there? You told me you were milking the cows." And they would howl, and my aunt would scream. And my father would look sheepish and say, "Yes, I'm sorry, Claus, I won't do that again." He'd say, "Well, take this and get out of here. I don't want to see you again." And he'd say, "Luther Ledbetter." All my relatives are all L's. Laurel, Luther, Leslie, Letha, Lura, and a bunch of them. They all come up one at a time and get these presents. And old Claus always knew something, some secret that they had. "Didn't I see you here? And isn't it true that you did this?" And he always brandished that knife, and Bill and I were just, our family was going to be just decapitated. The whole Ledbetter clan would probably be gone. We figured Christmas was a bloodbath. And when he finally got through the adults, he said, "All right, where are those little bastards?" He says, "Billy Ledbetter." And my cousin would always sort of lean on me to get out. I said, "I'm Jackie. I know, at least I know who I am." So Bill would go out there, his little short pants, and my cousin Bill's a mean bugger. He's a hard nose. Today he stands about 5'1". He's built like a bee. And we went through high school 1 year of constantly getting in fights. I'm a sort of a peace-loving person, basically, after an Irish temper, but Bill is just explosive. And somebody I remember in high school would go by that he didn't like for whatever reason. He'd say, he'd yell at the kid. And I said, "Bill, don't do that." And the kid would come back, and they'd usually be 3 or 4, and I'd have to help him. So we got in fights all the time. So Bill, even as a little kid, was mean. He'd walk up to Claus and look him in the eye. Claus say, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm Billy." He said, "What can you do?" He says, "Nothing." And Claus would look at him and says, "Well, get out of here." But then he knew he had better game than me. He said, "Now, Jackie Ledbetter, get up here." And I'd walk up there in my little short pants saying, "Don't wet your pants again in front of your father and your mother and disgrace yourself." He'd say, "Can you sing a song?" And he'd have that sword right up my throat. "And can you sing a song with a sword at your throat?" I'd say, "No, I can't." "What?" I said, "No, I can't sing a song." He said, "Can you recite a poem?" I said, "No, I can't do that either." There's snickers in the background from my uncles. He says, "Can you say anything?" I say, "No, Claus, I can't say anything." He says, "What good are you?" I says, "No good. No good whatsoever." And then he put that thing right up my throat, and he says, "Do you want a toy? Or shall I cut your head off right here and be done with you?" Look, what a choice. I said, toy, speak up. Toy, please, toy. And he'd read. He says, "There's nothing down there." And a little tear would form. He says, "Yes, there is too." And he'd reach down there and he says, "Well, here's something." It says, "Jackie Ledbetter. Is there a Jackie Ledbetter in this room? Are you Jackie Ledbetter? You little bastard." He'd hand it to me, he'd kick me in the butt, and away I'd go back on the table. And then he'd shake the bag, he'd say, "Well, you cutthroats." He says, "It's been another bad year. I'd rather go anywhere than see you Ledbetters," he said. And he'd stride to the door, and he'd open the door, and the snow would come in. His beard would be flowing, and he'd throw that thing over his back. He says, I don't know why I bother getting out of bed on Christmas for you people. He said, I've never seen such a band of cutthroats. And he'd stride right outside into the snow, and I'd hear the sleigh bells, and he'd turn at the last minute and look at us under that table with that sword. And he says, you little bastards. And boom, he closed the door, and he was gone. And Christmas was over again. And that's my Christmas. I don't know what kind of Christmases you had as children. But that's the way I was raised for a long time. I don't know, I'm going to stop telling that story because I probably won't stop telling it, but I've had people over the years come up later and said, that's not really true, is it? That's not really, and it is. Every word is true. In fact, it's probably worse. I mean, over the years, I've learned to objectify that a little bit. But when you're 5, you know, he was at least 10 feet tall. My relatives are still back there, and they don't do as much scaring anymore. They've mellowed a little bit.
Very close family.
Very close family. They laugh a lot. They get together at any, Halloween, Christmas. They live in the same town, so they're always calling each other, saying, Lura! And you got this horrible Southern Illinois, Southern Missouri, Northern Kentucky twang. They say, what do you want, Letha? I said, do you have any pies? I can get some. Good, come over. I got some hot dogs. And my uncle, who sits there in little bib overalls with his bare feet watching Jimmy Swaggart on TV and a little beagle dog in his lap, he'll say, you got any gravy? Yeah, we got gravy. Bring some gravy. So then they get together, the hot dogs, have a wiener roast, and they have all these nice pies, and my uncle will sit there and put gravy on his hot dogs, and he gets the cobbler, and he puts the gravy on the cobbler. He eats the gravy by itself, gives some to the little dog. And my Auntie Emma, everybody's got to have an Auntie Em, is making new cobblers of Jimmy Swaggart, preaching in the background. And it's all very homey and folksy. One day I came back from, I was spent a week in Gethsemane Abbey in Kentucky, where Merton lived. He was a monk for 27 years. And I'd studied there and read Merton and Catholic doctrine and all kinds of stuff. So when I left the monastery after getting up at 3 in the morning and praying the offices and going to bed at 8:30 with the monks and all that stuff, total silence for a week. And I left that and went to Southern Illinois immediately and walked into my aunt's kitchen. And there she was making more cobblers and my uncle sitting there watching the pretty, as my dad calls the television, and with his feet up, stocking feet up, with a little dog in his lap watching Jimmy Swaggart. And I thought, my gosh, I've gone from one monastery to another. I don't know which is real, which is the more important of the two. And my aunt would generally say something, do you like Jimmy Swaggart? And I don't really like Jimmy Swaggart. And I'd say, yes. And she'd say, he's a fine preacher, ain't he? You want some cobbler? I thought I said no. She would never say, do you want some cobbler? And her cobbler is renowned, so I just praise Jimmy Swaggart. I'd sit there and watch him with a little dog and my uncle, who was asleep. But I was a cobbler Christian. That's just a good term. Southern Illinois, I am. Yeah, but that's an interesting thing to go from the walls of a monastery in silence to a little town in Southern Illinois on the farm, where their values are different, their ideas are different, and you can't make value judgments and say this is Christianity here, and now this is Jimmy Swaggart, and we can. Doesn't matter. You know, it's really all one. And I think Thomas Merton would probably have been the first to agree with that what the chant, a Gregorian chant inside the walls, and my Aunt Emma's cobbler with Jimmy Swaggart on the pretty, and my little uncle with his dog on his lap, somehow is the same thing. I don't know if you want to get too philosophic about that and try to unravel it and say, tell me exactly how it's the same thing, then the whole thing is shot. So, but for me, it was the same thing. Well, there's my story. One of many. Got a story? A traveling tale? Children's tales?
Somewhat of a children's tale in that it happened just once. There was one other child that literally scared the foot out of me and hung with me. It hasn't happened for several years, probably, I don't know, 30, the last time that I remember waking up in a screaming cold sweat with a weight on my chest. But it had school by the manual. I went to bed in the bedroom with a couple of these kids, and they left the door to the room partly open, and I could hear my dad still out there counting out anything. 3, 2, 3, 4, no more. I dozed off. I didn't sleep as easily again as I did. But I woke up one time, and in the light from the door, I could look over and saw Joe's oldest daughter, who's about my age, lying in her cot with her eyes wide open and a big rat sitting right on her chest.
How old was this kid?
I was not
here. I mean, how old was the...
The girl?
Yeah.
She was my class later, so I sued you.
Mm-hmm.
And I woke up and... You talk about your throat taking up. I was so tight at that point that I let out a squawk. Joe came in and locked me. I told you to wash your face before you went to
bed.
Every now and then, or from the door, I would dream about this. If I got a weight on my chest, my hands were folded.
Yeah.
Any weight on my chest, I could wake up and see that.
Whoa. Was she awake? Watching her? Was she frightened?
She wasn't saying anything to
I can see you'd like that. Yeah. Good thing she had juice, or he might have bitten her. Oh, God. That's a gory one, Harry.
Joe was always referred to my dad in kind of an odd way. In reference to their partnership, one was the drifter and the other was the holder on. And the boilers. My dad always got the inside of the boiler because he was smaller and shifted the parts, unfortunately. But Joe was proud of his vocabulary. Some people have halitosis, but I have to. The relationship.
Oh, that's a good story. I have to remember that when I'm somewhere else telling stories. I'll say, my friend Harry up at Holden told a story about a rat.
Well, it looked like a horse or a rat. Yeah. I don't know how. It was
bigger.
It was as big sitting as like the face. It's the way I felt.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent the rest of my life shooting rats.
When we went back to, when was it? Just a few years ago to my dad's farm. Yeah, I guess it was over Easter. And my cousin, we'd been to church, I think it was Palm Sunday or Easter Sunday. And my cousin got back, he said, have you got your head, your post? And I said, what post? He says, you got your hedge post for the rats. Here I was dressed up in my suit. And I said, what do you mean if I got my hedge post? This is the same cousins that, this is still Jim and Bill growing up now. He's, yeah, and then my dad's farm. He says, well, we're going to kill rats today. I said, we are? He said, yeah. Go get your post. I said, what do you mean we're going to kill rats? Where do we kill them? He's in the chicken house. Uncle Lute will back his pickup under there, and we put a big hose on the exhaust, stick it down in one of the many rat holes, and wait about 5 minutes, and pretty soon those buggers come up sort of dizzy, and we just tee off on them and splat those suckers right against the wall. He says, there's a million rats in there. I said, I think I'll pass on that, I said. So I changed my clothes and went out there, and they were all standing out there and laughing, and all the women kind of standing around. Get us a rat now, Letha would say. Gilch, throw those big ones at me, though. And they'd laugh and push each other. I was standing there thinking, this is a heck of a way to spend Palm Sunday afternoon. And pretty soon, here come the rats up, kind of staggering out. They'd tee off on those things and bash them. And I got one, he'd pick them up with a tail and throw it at my Aunt Leith. And she'd run, oh, you got it down with blouse. And she'd throw it on, have a fit, and then knock another one. This went on for 15 minutes, and I could see rats flying. I wasn't having any fun, so finally I said, where can I get me one of those posts? I got one from Jim, and I started whacking those rats. We were in there for a half hour. We must have killed 30 rats, some big suckers coming out of there. And I thought, here, what am I doing? Good Christian man back in the Midwest, the heart of the country, on Palm Sunday, and I'm killing rats. It would have seemed the most natural thing in the world. We had a great pile of them afterwards. I have a strange family. Then my son came back. He got in on it. He had a shotgun, a 410 shotgun that I'd bought him. But he's not never really been a hunter, being a Californian, so he's not really used to guns. So he got out there and standing in the chicken house with everybody else whacking these rats. And one rat escaped somebody's club and went scurrying up the rafter and was hiding up on the rafter. And Tim saw him and whirled around and shot the shotgun and right over my uncle, who's a little guy. And my uncle was like this, and he heard that thing go off. And he ducked. And he looked at my son, and he says, what the hell are you doing? He looked up, there was a gaping hole in the top of the chicken house. The rat was nowhere to be seen. Tim said, I think I got him, Uncle Lute. I think I got him. My uncle looked at me and said, get that boy out of this chicken house. The great rat kill. Anybody got any more stories? Yeah.
It's interesting how one part of the story reminds of another. Yeah. The story about the golf clubs. The trip up here from California, I was visiting my folks in L.A. and my dad drove up here with me to Seattle for backpacking. And we started this thing about taking golf balls with us on long trips and hitting some golf clubs, and about three clubs, a 9-iron, 3-iron, and a driver. And we'd take them and try to find a spot where we could hit them. And we did this a couple of years ago, and so we decided to bring them along on this trip. And we were going all the way from California to Seattle and looking for the perfect spot. We drove most of the night, so we couldn't hit him during the night going to California. So we got to Oregon, and there are a lot of mountains in Southern Oregon. We were looking for a place where we could hit him, out over a peak, just so we could watch the ball in flight and just watch it sail. And I'd done this with a friend in Colorado. We'd gotten out on one of these beautiful vistas. There was a fence around it and people just watching. And my friend and I got out of golf clubs and just and just sailed. And people would watch. Get our golf clubs back, put them in the car, and drive home. It's kind of a neat thing for my dad and I. So he was sleeping and I found this spot and pulled over the side of the road. Good spot. He woke up and said, no, it's no good, no good. Keep driving. So we drove a little ways and found this little hill and overlooked this lake, and there's some cows around the area. And there's a little side road kind of just beyond the highway. And so we decided this is the perfect spot. This is about, maybe 20 miles south of got out, and we had about 20 balls, and we started whacking them. Some would hit in the lake, and some would, top them and just roll. And see, that's a waste of ball. You don't go out and fetch them. They're just old balls. So I got out my driver, and I was just going to wear away, and we kind of set them up on, we didn't have tees, we set them up on a little patch of grass or on a rock. Clubs weren't the best either, so it didn't matter. And I got back, and there's this car driving on that side road, and it was way to the left. I'm driving this way. I just reared back, and the ball went that way. I'm watching it, and the car is going like this, the ball's going like this, and going, no, no! I hit this, clunk, clunk. Went down on the hill, and what should we do? And I wanted to run, take all the help, and just get out of there, because my car was parked on the side of the building, obviously. There's a guardrail right there. You know, I don't really trust my dad. I says, I think I hit that car. It's just, I thought it was stopping and checking the, you know, the damage and come right back and you know, say, okay, you owe us $500. And, but we just waited there. And my heart was passed. But this was like a week ago. And I was just scared, you know, because I would have to pay for it. My insurance was
try to explain a golf ball. And
so, the car never came back. You know, we waited about 5 minutes, and we got in our car, and we said, let's wait a couple more. Let's hit the golf ball. So we stopped at the rest stop, and maybe we hit the golf course with the trees.
Have you ever thought of doing it in the Grand Canyon? That's an interesting, a lot of room to drive there. That's a good story. Yeah. You got any more? Everybody's
that's
got stories.
Any person does some unique thing. That's interesting when you look at someone. You know, I would ever dream they'd do that. Golf ball. Everybody has something.
That's my dream. You play this golf ball. When you guys are back.
Well, I'll tell you briefly about what happened one time we were driving back. After I got used to growing up and going on the trail, then when I did my graduate work in Nebraska, I was kind of reliving my father's thing. Dolores and I and the three kids would always be in an old Ford station wagon back to Nebraska and have five bicycles or three bicycles tied up on top with books and a typewriter in the back, and usually a dog or two. And one trip we had three dogs. We went, and I to this day can't figure out why in the heck we traveled with three dogs in the back with three kids in a station wagon. And Dolores, by the time we got to Las Vegas, was a nervous wreck with three kids and three dogs and everything falling off. And the car always, of course, every time I've gone on a trip anywhere, the car falls apart. Always on a Sunday, always in a town where there are no mechanics. And I smell something, or you hear a rattle, what's that rattle? Or you say, do you smell something? Or a gauge is going on to hot. And I say, oh God, what does that mean? And I have no mechanics. So I'm always paranoid. And I think we're coming in Cedar City, Utah, or someplace like that. And she was at the end of her rope by that time. And just fainted dead away. I've had it, just passed out. And we had to stop and get the car fixed or something, and we finally got a motel. And Blackie, our little black dog, I set some food down. First of all, we sneaked him into the motel and set some food down. He promptly ate it and threw up on the rug. And Dolores said, get those dogs out of here. So I grabbed the dog, Missy, the dog who was really nobody home. Her father was a polar bear. She's a big horse of a white dog, her eyes sort of crossed. And she was starting to chew on the bolster around the bed. And she said, get those dogs out of here. So I said, come on, dogs. And I grabbed the dogs, and I said, we better let this woman have some peace and quiet. So I took them down to a park. I said, no, you can't get in any trouble in the park. Just run and relax, and I'll take you back. Here I am talking to three dogs. It shows you how far gone I was.
Oh, you had three kids.
Three kids. They were back at the motel. So I was sitting down there, and pretty soon I was sort of dozing, looking out over this park, and there was a baseball game going on the other side. And I noticed pretty soon I was yelling and screaming like any baseball game. Pretty soon I looked over there, and they were all running in the same direction. I thought, that's a heck of a baseball game. They're all, instead of playing their positions, they're all running. I said, what are they running at? I looked out, and there's this white dog over there, and they're chasing this white dog. I looked around, I said, you dogs see that? Where are you dogs? And it was my dogs. They had stolen the baseball. They grabbed the ball and was running with it. And all, here comes the whole baseball team towards me. And I said, go that way. Well, they finally grabbed the dog, and they were almost going to kill the dog. They got the baseball out of its mouth, and they came over. Pretty soon, here comes this government pickup truck. And I thought, now I've had it. I grabbed the dogs like that, and the guy pulls up, and he says, them your dogs? I said, yes, sir. He says, you a dog trainer? Would you like to have a job training dogs? I said, training dogs? I was ready. I said, no, sir. we went back to the motel, got him in, locked him in the bathroom, tried to get some sleep. Middle of the night, Dolores is nudging me. She says, Jack, what's that noise? I said, what noise? She said, listen to that. I said, I don't hear anything. She said, no, I hear something. I heard this slosh, 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 slosh. Yeah. I said, what the heck is that? I got up and I peeked out the shutters and the car was okay. And I looked around, slosh, slosh. It's coming from the bathroom. I walked over, opened the bathroom, and there's my little black dog. He's falling in the stool. He's paddling. Trying to keep his head above water. I lifted him out, dried him off. There sat Missy with her eyes crossed. Could have cared less. So we went into the next town, on up into Utah. And I forget, we stopped up through Heber Valley or some such place. We stopped for coffee. And usually we, very like my father, very frugal dinner. We'd eat whatever we had in the box in the back seat. If the kids hadn't destroyed it or the dogs hadn't wet on it, that's what we ate. And I said, Dolores says, we've got to sit down and have a meal. I said, all right, we'll go in this little cafe here. She said, what about the dogs? You know, there they are, panting and slobbering over everything and fouling up the back of the station. I said, I'll get them out. So I took them out. There's a little picket fence around the cafe about 50 yards from where we were going to go in. So each one had a leash, and I looped it over there and made a little loop. And said, no, I gave them their little water plates and a little bone for the dogs. I said, be happy and sit here. And we went in and got a cup of coffee. Got the kids settled and told them what they could order. I said, you get 39 cents a piece, no more. And naturally, they ordered the whole menu. And we're sitting there having our coffee, and I hear the people in the next booth starting to talk about, look at that, Harry, look at that. I was so tired, I didn't want to look at that. I've been driving all night. Finally, she says, look at that, they're coming this way. I thought, what's coming this way? I looked out the window, here comes the picket fence. The dogs had broken the picket fence, and the whole picket fence was coming. You know how they're stretching like their necks like they're this. And the whole picket fence is coming my way. And by this time, the whole restaurant's looking, and people are coming to the windows. And he said, who owns those dogs? So I said, that's it, the dinner's over. We ran out, undid the got in the car, and took off, and the picket fence was just sort of lying there like a ribbon. Got to the campsite that night. Missy, the white dog who's crazy, barked constantly. The minute the sun was down, she became Dracula dog, and she barked. So we were all lying in bags. We were very poor campers. We had five sleeping bags and a big sheet of plastic, and I'd get all the kids all lined up like sardines, and we'd pull the plastic up over the bags to keep off the worst of the dew, and that's the way we camped. Everybody else with their Sony TV inside their big Airstream homes, you know, and their big 18-story thing, with their Bermuda shorts and long black dress socks and wingtip shoes and really roughing it. And there we were right on the bloody ground. And the dog, as soon as it was dark, Missy would go, roof, roof, and I'd say, oh, there's that dumb dog. So I knew this was going to happen. So before we got down, I'd always get a little pile of stones, a little pile of rocks. And I'd tie one dog over here to this tree and one dog to this tree and Missy somewhere else. And I forgot I'd tied her chain next to one of the trash cans. And she started moving around. That chain would rattle against that trash can. And she'd go, and I'd pick up a stone and I'd chuck it in the general direction and say, shut up, damn your eyes. And I hit this can. It would rattle and she'd go, and the other dog, and over here. So I have this triumvirate of dogs. Pretty soon I'm throwing rocks. The kids are rattling around. They're saying, what's wrong, Dad? Is it a bear? And then Becky's crying. Dolores is fainting again. And then the lights go on the Sony. And the lights go on in the Airstream. The lights go on. Pretty soon one guy opened the window. He looked out. He had a big flashlight, like one of those big things. He was going like that. And the dogs are barking. And trash cans falling over. And neighbors are yelling. And he sees us down here on the ground. And I could see the light. Pretty soon he picks up a dog. Then another dog. And he says, Martha, come here. There's some poor son of a bitch out here with three dogs, and they're all in their sleeping bags. Look at this. And they had a great fix at Arks. They laughed, and they thought it was hilarious. Finally got the dogs quieted, and they went back to bed. Everything got quieted down. The lights one at a time went off, and we were quiet. Pretty soon, that would start all over again. So that's the way we traveled, from campsite to campsite. Anybody else got any stories, or should we just...
We never stopped to sleep.
We had our cars breaking down. We had, living in California, we felt a compulsion to go to school in the Midwest, I guess. We were married at the time. My brothers were going to Valparaiso, and we were living in St. Louis. It was Christmas time, I guess. We decided to head out to California for vacation. We had just bought a 74 VW bus. And my brother in Valparaiso had a full 68 Volvo station wagon, which he had got license plates for. It said Foggy One on it. And it had been through the mill several times. The rear end had something wrong with it. He replaced everything twice. But it still sounded like a 707 taking off.
It sounded like he just never lifted.
Yeah,
it kept going down.
It's just the exact sound before liftoff.
Constantly.
And so we were going to ride out with my two brothers out in California. Talked to him on the phone. I said, well, you drive down here and we'll drive a new bus out. And he says, no, we can go a lot faster in foggy. And I said, but it'll be a lot more comfortable in the bus because we're just going to drive straight through. And I said, we can take turns. I know
he's just driving.
No, we'll take foggy. Okay, so we drove out. They came down, we drove out in foggy. And it was, I mean, my two brothers came with earplugs. and nervous wreck by the time we got there. And we were there for 4 or 5 days before we had to turn around and come back. And we were headed back, and where I was teaching, St. Louis, she had to be back to teach from January 2nd or 3rd. And we were coming back, and it was New Year's Eve, and we were in Wyoming. And we usually come across there from Salt Lake City to Cheyenne and go down Denver and across Kansas there. And there was this Mark, we've come this way so many times, every gas station, every rest stop, and there's this little cutoff that cuts between Laramie and Fort Collins, a little two-lane that runs down through the mountains, and it saves you 40 miles or so. So we're going to take that, and it's about 10:30 at night, New Year's Eve, and it was snowing, and the gas gauge is on empty, right on empty. We're coming into Laramie. Are we going to make it into Laramie? Yeah, well, Mark says, we'll make it. We'll make it. There's no problem. I know there's 2 gallons left in the tank. And so we did. We made it into Laramie. We pulled it in. And we were just sigh of breath of relief. And there was a place open on New Year's Eve, the gas station open. And so we all went and used the bathroom, got a can of coffee, and we were ready to take off on this little two-laner down to Fort Collins. And we got back on the road and I looked over the gas station. It was still on empty. And I said, Mark, did you fill up? He said, oh, I just got $1 worth. I said, Mark. He said, Fort Collins, there's a gas station I know. It's always the cheapest. I said, this is New Year's Eve. You got $1 of gas at 10:30 at night. And it was snowing. It was about 3 inches of fresh snow on the road. So we start down this two-laner towards Fort Collins. We get about halfway. We're about 50 miles out of there, 50 miles from Fort Collins. And all of a sudden, the headlights start to go dim. And they start to go dimmer and dimmer, and a red light comes on the dash. And Mark says, you better turn off the radio. So we turn off the radio, and things keep going dimmer and dimmer. And he says, oh, it's the generator brush, it slips on, there you go. And we turned off the heater, turned off everything except for the faucet. And they kept going dimmer and dimmer. And he says, well, if we can get behind another car, we can just follow it in, because it's getting so it's hard to see the road even. And so we got behind this little Pinto that was going on the road, and it was snowing pretty good. And he turned off the headlights. Because it got to be where it could slow down, the engine would start to falter. There wasn't enough electricity left to run the plugs. And so he turned off the headlights, and we followed this Pinto down the mountain. And we followed it for about 20 minutes, and then the Pinto realized there was somebody following it with no lights on. Figured there was something wrong, which there was, and it pulled over,
So our windows go down.
And all our windows go down. Don't stop. Every time it slowed down, the car started and so he started up again, and we followed this Pinto all the way down. And And we hit Fort Collins right at midnight. It's 9:00 p.m. And we pulled into the first gas station that was there, and they were just turning off the overhead lights and everything on. And the guy says, "No, we're closed. You know, but if you want to work on the car, go ahead." And so Mark lifted up the hood and he pulled off his generator and fiddled around with it, and sure enough, the brushes were shot on the generator, but he jammed it through a little further. And we pushed the car on, started, and the light went on. The lights came back on. It's gonna work. Let's keep going. So we pulled through Fort Collins, and we got to the far edge of town. All of a sudden, the light goes on, the headlights go down, you know. And we pulled into the gas station right there, and he turned off the lights. This is where we pulled in.
Oh, no.
I said, "We're staying here." And there's a motel.
Edge Hotel Motel.
Yeah, so we pulled out a bottle of wine from the luggage, and all four of us stayed in the room that night. Fortunately, the next morning, Mark called around to all the auto places, and there was a guy doing inventory for New Year's Day.
Oh.
So we made it back to the
same. Oh, that's great. Makes you wonder if anybody ever travels normally, because so many people have these kinds of horror tales.
The nice thing is, like when I hear your stories, that's how my husband always traveled, and, you know, going to school in Nebraska, living in California. And
well, we couldn't, because we made the trip too before we were married, and our moral scruples, or our parents' moral scruples, said we couldn't stay in a hotel. And, you know, so we drive for 3 to 6 hours straight.
I remember one trip though that we made in a VW bug with three other people and two guitars and two dogs. that was a fun trip too.
Stories of the road.
And I think that I always thought that was terrible when I heard stories about parents who would go on trips and leave without a kid. I thought that's, how could you ever do that?
With all of your dogs.
I said, how could anyone ever do that? Well, this is a true story also. We were in Las Vegas. We'd never gone to Las Vegas except to go through.
Because they have bathrooms open on
the Yeah.
And we were stopped at a gas station, and this was the trip. This is a trip with the three dogs and the three kids. Well, our people always marvel that we traveled so much and camped so much with our three kids. And they actually were very normal kids and got along reasonably well, except the way they did it, the boys built a barricade between themselves. They'd get tied one another, and that would be one side, and this would, you know, the kid, this is my side, and nothing passes my side. This is my space. And Becky would be up with us. They had built this big barricade up the middle of sleeping bags and whatever they could have. And then, of course, the three dogs and the turmoil of those dogs was just about more than I could handle. Two dogs were very well behaved. It was the white one that caused all the problems. And Tim, our oldest son, and the other two dogs would not spoil the place. But that white dog would. And then are the two dogs would be up on the side, and Tim had said, "They're up on the side again, get out, hand me the paper towels." It would mean that white one had disgraced herself again. And Tim said, "We've got to get rid of this dog, Dad. We've got to get rid of this dog." Well, this is how it was. And we stopped in Las Vegas, so I just said to Jack, "Tim is right. This dog has got to go." And he said, "Well, we can't do anything about it now. We're on the way to Nebraska. And we'll do something about it if it gets worse." He said, "When we get home, it's worse." And so here we are. And he says, "Don't worry, I'll get the dogs out." He says, Tim goes back, and he helps his dad get the dogs out. And James went into the bathroom. And I'm getting Becky out, and she's crying because it's the middle of the night. And we woke her up, and she's crying, and I'm trying to take care of her. And we finally get all three dogs back, and they're going crazy, the white one and the
the guy in the attendant's afraid that she's going to bite him, and oh, I mean, it's just massive turmoil. This is the middle of the night. Well, we all get back in. We're all in. And I sort of rest at ease, and Jack gets, starts the motor, and we start him down. And oh boy, we're off. Maybe they'll all go back to sleep. We've been driving all night. And pretty soon, Mom, Mom, and Tim goes, Mom, we don't have James. James is up there. I said, well, he has to be there. And he says, well, I didn't notice, but I didn't look through. He says, I didn't hear him, but I peeked through, and there's nobody on the phone. And I said, that's it. It can't be. And I looked at him, and I said, Jack, he's not there.
We did that once. My sister crossed weird. There were eight of us. We took a, you know, a big old Buick station wagon, and it was somewhere in Utah, gas station. You know, we all got out. I drove away. You know, several miles down the road. If I was sitting in the back, I said, "Boy, where's Chris?" I thought she was back there with you. You know, and it took several miles of unbelief, you know.
Yeah.
Must be in here somewhere. Yeah. You know, looking around.
I'm glad
we got that, you know. Finally convinced Dad that, no, she's not in here. So we turned around and got back to the gas station. She was standing there, and the attendants were just howling. I mean, she was so humiliated. Oh.
Well, that's the way James was. He was standing there like this. He would wear glasses anyway. You know, he'd stand there so self-righteous, and he said, "You forgot."
Good stories, folks. Thank you.